Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the January 25th Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today, we'll be reading the following main articles. 5-year-old boy killed. Woman faces murder charge in Aurora fire by Sam Tabachnik. Congress. Report advises Lamborn subpoena. Ethics Office says it found evidence the congressman misused official resources by Conrad Swanson. 1991 Grand Junction pipe bombings. Man convicted of murder seeking a new trial through Innocence Project by Shelley Bradbury. Ukraine. U.S. places 8,500 troops on high alert by Robert Burns and Lorne Cook. And following up with miscellaneous articles. 5-year-old boy killed. Woman faces murder charge in Aurora fire by Sam Tabachnik, The Denver Post. Police investigating a deadly apartment fire in Aurora arrested a 37-year-old woman on suspicion of first-degree murder Monday, alleging she intentionally started an overnight blaze that killed a 5-year-old boy and injured 8 others. Aurora police detectives believe Alondra Michael was involved in a domestic violence incident inside a Belaterra apartment and intentionally set something inside of the apartment on fire, which quickly spread to adjacent units, including the second-story apartment where the 5-year-old was found, officials said in a news release. In addition to the first-degree murder charge, Michael also faces 1 count of first-degree arson and 3 counts of attempted first-degree murder, authorities said. Formal charges will be filed by the 18th Judicial District Attorney's Office. 3 people were hospitalized in the early morning fire at the apartment complex at 15320 East Evans Avenue, while emergency personnel said they made multiple rescues from the 3-story building. Authorities said 31 residents have been displaced, including a family of Afghan refugees. Jasmine Murray woke around 1:20 a.m. Monday morning to the sound of her neighbor banging frantically on the door of her Aurora apartment, telling her to leave immediately. As she fled the building, Murray saw a neighbor desperately trying to put out the flames with the fire extinguisher, to no avail. A mother wailed, "My baby," as windows shattered from the fast-moving fire. Murray watched rescue crews put a child on a stretcher, giving him CPR before whisking him away. "That scream from the mother," Murray said Monday morning outside the charred building, choking back tears, "that really got me." Multiple residents told the Denver Post they didn't hear any fire alarms Monday morning, even as the flames and smoke rapidly approached their homes. "Thank God my neighbor banged on my door," Murray said, adding that it only took a couple of minutes for the fire to engulf the entire building. "It burned so fast and so hot." The fire was under control later Monday morning with Xcel Energy and Red Cross responding to assist firefighters. Fire crews on Monday morning could be seen shoveling charred debris and sifting through the wreckage from the apartment complex. Adjoining units on either side of the fire were still standing with little visible damage. Neighbors loitered in the parking lot outside, chatting and waiting for authorities to let them inspect their homes. One resident said he threw a suitcase full of important documents out his second-floor window, then jumped himself to escape the flames. When Benito Morales opened his apartment door to flee the building, the flames were so close, they almost touched his face. He left everything inside, his car keys, wallet, phone, as the fire descended on his apartment. When Dante Passalacqua and his fiancée Julie were woken up in the middle of the night, they could barely see out of their apartment window, the smoke billowing thick. They grabbed their car keys and cat, banging on neighbors' doors to alert them. After they made it to the breezeway outside the apartment, they turned back. The entire building was on fire. Passalacqua heard the mother screaming for her child and watched the father try to go back in. He couldn't make it. "Everybody seemed pretty rough," Passalacqua said. Aurora police request anyone with information to call Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. Tipsters can remain anonymous and are eligible for a reward of up to $2,000. Reporter Jake Shapiro contributed to this report. Congress. Report advises Lamborn subpoena. Ethics Office says it found evidence the congressman misused official resources. By Conrad Swanson, The Denver Post. U.S. Representative Doug Lamborn should be investigated by the House Committee on Ethics for allegations that his staff ran personal errands for his wife and helped his son apply for federal jobs, the Office of Congressional Ethics recommended Monday. A former staff member of the Colorado Springs Republican leveled those allegations against him in a lawsuit filed in federal court early last year, which also accused him of disregarding COVID-19 safety protocols in the early days of the pandemic. The lawsuit also claimed that Lamborn allowed his son to live in the basement of the U.S. Capitol rent-free. The House Board of the Office of Congressional Ethics also investigated the allegations. The office released a report Monday saying that there is substantial reason to believe Lamborn misused official resources and solicited or accepted improper gifts from subordinates. For more information, the committee should subpoena Lamborn, among others, the office's report recommends. The office found that Lamborn's wife had access to an official House email account, and evidence showed that she had a role in the office that exceeded what is permissible for spouses. That role, multiple staffers told investigators, included hiring, firing, and promoting employees. Staffers told investigators that they would run personal errands for the Lamborns as well, like picking up mail, feeling as though they were required to comply with her requests. They also told investigators that Dale Anderson, Lamborn's chief of staff, who has repeatedly ignored interview requests, would underscore Mrs. Lamborn's requests as a priority. When one staff member asked Anderson about this practice, he told them, "If mama ain't happy, nobody's happy," the report says. Staff members also told investigators they helped Lamborn's son apply for a job at the Pentagon, which he ultimately received. That work included reviewing his resume, evaluating job postings, and asking mock interview questions, the report says. Lamborn told investigators his son received the same help his office would give to any constituent, but the office found testimonial and documentary evidence indicating otherwise, the report says. In fact, it is unclear whether the son was a constituent of Colorado's 5th Congressional District during this time, the report says. Anderson would also solicit gifts from staff members for the Lamborns for special occasions like holidays and birthdays, they told investigators. They did not interpret those requests from Anderson as voluntary, the report says. Lamborn acknowledged to investigators that he does regularly receive gifts from staff members in Colorado and Washington, D.C., and said his family returns the favor. Investigators did not find any evidence that staffers received the same types of gifts Representative Lamborn and Mrs. Lamborn received during special occasions, the report says. Emails obtained by the Denver Post also indicated that Anderson solicited gifts from staff members and that staffers were running personal errands for Lamborn's wife. The House Ethics Manual forbids staff to do anything unrelated to official congressional duties. The issue arose several times in recent years. In 2018, former GOP Representative Tom Garrett of Virginia made staffers pick up groceries, clothes, and dog poop. And an inspector general's report also found that former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and his wife, Susan Pompeo, repeatedly misused State Department staff for personal business, violating the department's ethical standards. After the lawsuit was filed last year, Lamborn claimed that the allegations consist of a tissue of lies. On Monday, Cassandra Sebastian, the congressman's spokeswoman, called the information collected by the Office of Congressional Ethics overzealous. The allegations are unfounded and have no merit, Sebastian said. The congressman also wrote a letter to that effect last month as well, claiming the ethics complaint stems from a lawsuit filed by a disgruntled employee looking for a financial jackpot. Because evidence does indicate Lamborn might have misused office resources and solicited or accepted improper gifts, the Office of Congressional Ethics recommended that the larger House Committee on Ethics further review the allegations. In addition, the office recommended that the committee issue subpoenas to Lamborn, Anderson, and three others, each of whom would not provide certain information that had been requested. 1991 Grand Junction pipe bombings. Man convicted of murder seeking new trial through Innocence Project, by Shelley Bradbury, The Denver Post. Nearly three decades after James Genrich was convicted of planting a series of pipe bombs in Grand Junction that killed two people and terrorized the community for months, the now 59-year-old returned to court Monday to argue that the guilty verdict was based on bogus evidence and should be overturned. Attorneys for Genrich, who is serving life in prison for first-degree murder, argued in Mesa County District Court that the prosecution's most critical piece of evidence in the case, an expert's opinion that tools Genrich owned made marks on the bombs, was flawed and that Genrich should be granted a new trial. That might have been enough to convict Mr. Genrich 30 years ago, but is not enough today, said Tanya Brief, an attorney with the Innocence Project, a nonprofit organization dedicated to exonerating wrongly convicted people. During Genrich's 1993 jury trial in Greeley, an expert for the prosecution matched tool marks on the bombs to three tools owned by Genrich and told the jury that the marks on the bombs must have been made by Genrich's tools. The expert said his analysis excluded the use of any other tools. But a 2009 report by the National Academy of Sciences cast doubt on the experts' methods, finding that the practice of tool mark analysis was not scientifically validated and could lead to incorrect conclusions. The tool marks were the only physical evidence tying Genrich to the crimes, and his conviction was controversial from the beginning. The case against him involved prosecutorial misconduct, tactics by law enforcement that a judge called reprehensible, and a contempt of court charge for the prosecution's tool mark expert because he refused to turn over evidence to the defense despite court orders. Mesa County District Attorney Dan Rubenstein said Monday he believes the tool mark analysis that tied Genrich to the bombings was accurate. I stand by the conviction, and I stand by the reliability of the tool mark evidence, he said. The experts that we have consulted with and intend to call at the hearing, we believe will support that this is reliable. The Colorado Court of Appeals in 2019 found that Genrich was entitled to a hearing to determine whether he should have been given a new trial because of the potentially flawed tool mark evidence. The hearing, which began Monday, is expected to last through Wednesday. District Court Judge Richard Gurley then has several weeks in which to decide whether Genrich should be given a new trial. Genrich has maintained his innocence since the 1991 attacks. Then 28, Genrich was living in downtown Grand Junction and working at the Two Rivers Convention Center when a bomb went off in the center's parking garage on February 14, 1991. A man was injured, but no one was killed in that bombing. In April 1991, a family got into their van in Grand Junction to go shopping, and a bomb under a wheel well exploded, killing 12-year-old Maria Dolores Gonzalez. Just weeks later, in June, Henry Rubel, 43, and his wife were driving home from dinner in downtown Grand Junction when they spotted a strange object in the restaurant parking lot. Rubel picked it up and died when it exploded. Investigators at the time faced immense public pressure to identify the bomber, and Genrich became a top suspect when he went to a bookstore after the three bombings and asked for a book that included instructions on bomb making. Prosecutors relied heavily on circumstantial evidence to build the case, including notes Genrich wrote that were found in his apartment, in which he expressed his desire to kill women and said he might harm innocents. Genrich had been seen in some of the areas where the 1991 bombs detonated and lived within walking distance of two sites. He'd studied electronics, and investigators found two fuses in his apartment that were the same type as those used in the bombs. Investigators did not find any gunpowder, schematics, or bomb-making tools in Genrich's apartment. They did seize some of his tools, which the expert later matched to marks on an unexploded bomb that had been discovered in Grand Junction in 1989. However, Genrich lived in Phoenix in 1989 and was at work in a bookstore there when the first bomb was placed in Grand Junction. During the trial, prosecutors suggested he may have worked with an accomplice, but never named anyone. Additionally, a white vehicle was seen at each of the 1991 bombings, and Genrich did not own or have access to a vehicle. A witness also testified that he saw a Spanish-looking man handling one of the bombs. Genrich is white. Genrich never admitted to the bombings, even when investigators followed him round the clock for months, and his parents secretly wore a wire and tried to get him to confess. In a 1993 interview with the Denver Post, Genrich said the homicidal notes he wrote were a practice he picked up in therapy to write down what he was feeling instead of going out and losing his temper. Genrich quickly appealed the 1993 conviction. The Mesa County District Attorney who prosecuted the case, Stephen Erkenbrack, told the Post that he had no doubt about Genrich's guilt. He declined to comment Sunday. Months after Genrich's conviction, the Post reported that enough doubt lingered in Grand Junction about his guilt that, even months after the verdict, some residents still checked their cars for bombs before leaving their driveways. Ukraine. U.S. places 8,500 troops on high alert, by Robert Burns and Lauren Cook, The Associated Press, by Line Washington. The Pentagon ordered 8,500 troops on higher alert Monday to potentially deploy to Europe as part of a NATO response force amid growing concern that Russia could soon make a military move on Ukraine. President Joe Biden consulted with key European leaders, underscoring U.S. solidarity with allies there. Putting the U.S.-based troops on heightened alert for Europe suggested diminishing hope that Russian President Vladimir Putin will back away from what Biden himself has said looks like a threat to invade neighboring Ukraine. At stake, beyond the future of Ukraine, is the credibility of a NATO alliance that is central to U.S. defense strategy, but that Putin views as a Cold War relic and a threat to Russian security. For Biden, the crisis represents a major test of his ability to forge a united allied stance against Putin. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby said about 8,500 U.S.-based troops are being put on alert for possible deployment, not to Ukraine, but to NATO territory in Eastern Europe as part of an alliance force meant to signal a unified commitment to deter any wider Putin aggression. Russia denies it is planning an invasion. It says Western accusations are merely a cover for NATO's own planned provocations. Recent days have seen high-stakes diplomacy that has failed to reach any breakthrough, and key players in the drama are making moves that suggest fear of imminent war. Biden has sought to strike a balance between actions meant to deter Putin and those that might provide the Russian leader with an opening to use the huge force he has assembled at Ukraine's border. Biden held an 80-minute video call with several European leaders on the Russian military buildup and potential responses to an invasion. I had a very, very, very good meeting. Total unanimity with all the European leaders, Biden told reporters at the White House. We'll talk about it later. The White House said the leaders emphasized their desire for a diplomatic solution to the crisis, but also discussed efforts to deter further Russian aggression, including preparations to impose massive consequences and severe economic costs on Russia for such actions, as well as to reinforce security on NATO's eastern flank. A day earlier, the State Department had ordered the families of all American personnel at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv to leave the country, and it said that non-essential embassy staff could leave at U.S. government expense. Ukraine's former ministry spokesman, Oleg Nikolenko, said that U.S. decision was a premature step and a sign of excessive caution. He said Russia was sowing panic among Ukrainians and foreigners in order to destabilize Ukraine. Britain said it, too, was withdrawing some diplomats and dependents from its Kyiv embassy. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said an invasion was not inevitable, but the intelligence is pretty gloomy. Ordering even a modest number of American troops to be ready for potential deployment to Europe is meant to demonstrate U.S. resolve to support its NATO allies, particularly those in Eastern Europe who feel threatened by Russia and worry that Putin could put them in his crosshairs. What this is about is reassurance to our NATO allies, Kirby told a Pentagon news conference, adding that no troops are intended for deployment to Ukraine, which is not a member of the alliance, but has been assured by Washington of continued U.S. political support and arms supplies. The Pentagon's move, which was done at Biden's direction and on Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's recommendation, is being made in tandem with actions by other NATO member governments to bolster a defensive presence in Eastern European nations. Denmark, for example, is sending a frigate and F-16 warplanes to Lithuania. Spain is sending 4 fighter jets to Bulgaria and 3 ships to the Black Sea to join NATO naval forces. And France stands ready to send troops to Romania. In a statement prior to Kirby's announcement, NATO said the Netherlands plans to send 2 F-35 fighter aircraft to Bulgaria in April and is putting a ship and land-based units on standby for NATO's response force. NATO has not made a decision to activate the response force, which consists of about 40,000 troops from multiple nations. That force was enhanced in 2014, the year Russia seized Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula and intervened in support of pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine by creating a spearhead force of about 20,000 troops on extra high alert within the larger response force. If NATO does decide to activate the response force, the United States will contribute a range of military units, Kirby said. It is a NATO call to make, Kirby said. For our part, we wanted to make sure that we were ready in case that call should come. And that means making sure that units that would contribute to it are as ready as they can be on as short a notice as possible. He said some units will be ordered to be ready to deploy in as little as 5 days' notice. Among the 8,500 troops, an unspecified number could be sent to Europe for purposes other than supporting the NATO response force, he said. Without providing details, he said they might be deployed if other situations develop. Before the U.S. announcement, NATO issued a statement summing up moves already described by member countries. Restating them under the NATO banner appeared aimed at showing resolve. The West is ramping up its rhetoric in the information war that has accompanied the Ukraine standoff. Russia has massed an estimated 100,000 troops near Ukraine's border, demanding that NATO promise that it will never allow Ukraine to join, and that other actions such as stationing alliance troops in former Soviet bloc countries be curtailed. NATO said Monday it is bolstering its deterrence in the Baltic Sea region. The alliance will take all necessary measures to protect and defend all allies, Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said. We will always respond to any deterioration of our security environment, including through strengthening our collective defense. In Moscow, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said it was NATO and the U.S. who were behind the escalating tensions, not Russia. This is all happening not because of what we, Russia, are doing. This is happening because of what NATO, the U.S., are doing, Peskov told reporters. The NATO announcement came as European Union foreign ministers sought to put on their own fresh display of unity in support of Ukraine and paper over concerns about divisions on the best way to confront any Russian aggression. In a statement, the ministers said the EU has stepped up sanction preparations and they warned that any further military aggression by Russia against Ukraine will have massive consequences and severe costs. Soldiers say military junta now controls Burkina Faso. By Sam Mednick, the Associated Press, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso. More than a dozen mutinous soldiers declared Monday on state television that a military junta had seized control of Burkina Faso after detaining the democratically elected president following a day of gun battles in the capital of the West African country. The military coup in a nation that was once a bastion of stability was a third of its kind in the region in the last 18 months, creating upheaval in some of the country's hardest hit by Islamic extremist attacks. Captain Sidsori Kaber Kwadrago said the Patriotic Movement for Safeguarding and Restoration has decided to assume its responsibility before history. The soldiers put an end to Kabore's presidency because of the deteriorating security situation and the president's inability to manage the crisis, he said. It was not immediately known where President Rochmark Christian Kabore was, and the junta spokesman said only that the coup had taken place without any physical violence against those arrested who are being held in a safe place with respect for their dignity. A soldier in the mutiny, who spoke on condition of anonymity due to the sensitivity of the situation, told the Associated Press that Kabore had submitted his resignation. The new military regime said it had suspended Burkina Faso's constitution and dissolved the National Assembly. The country's borders were closed, and a curfew was in effect from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. Ouagadougou said that the country's new leaders would work to establish a calendar acceptable to everyone for holding new elections, without giving further details. After the televised announcement, crowds took to the streets, cheering and honking car horns in support of the takeover. Many hoped that the coup would ease the devastation they have endured since jihadist violence spread across the country. This is an opportunity for Burkina Faso to regain its integrity. The previous regime sunk us. People are dying daily. Soldiers are dying. There are thousands of displaced, said Manuel Sip, a protester in downtown Ouagadougou. The army should have acted faster in ousting the president, he said. After the overthrow of strongman Blaise Compaoré in 2014, several people told the AP they no longer cared if they had a democratically elected leader. They just wanted to live in peace. The communique read aloud on state broadcaster RTB was signed by the country's apparent new military leader, Lieutenant Colonel Paul-Henri Sandiago Damiba. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on coup leaders to lay down their arms. He reiterated the UN's full commitment to the preservation of the constitutional order in Burkina Faso and support for the people in their efforts to find solutions to the multifaceted challenges facing the country, UN spokesman Stéphane Dujarric said. Affirmative action. Court to hear challenge to race in admissions by Mark Sherman, the Associated Press. The conservative-dominated Supreme Court on Monday agreed to hear a challenge to the consideration of race in college admissions, adding affirmative action to major cases on abortion, guns, religion, and COVID-19 already on the agenda. The court said it will take up lawsuits claiming that Harvard University, a private institution, and the University of North Carolina, a state school, discriminate against Asian American applicants. A decision against the schools could mean the end of affirmative action in college admissions. Lower courts rejected the challenges, citing more than 40 years of high court rulings that allow colleges and universities to consider race in admissions decisions, but the colleges and universities must do so in a narrowly tailored way to promote diversity. The court's most recent pronouncement was in 2016, in a 4-3 decision upholding the admission program at the University of Texas against a challenge brought by a white woman. But the composition of the court has changed since then, with the addition of 3 conservative justices who were appointed by then-President Donald Trump. 2 members of that 4-justice majority are gone from the court. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died in 2020, and Justice Anthony Kennedy retired in 2018. The 3 dissenters in the case, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, remain on the court. Roberts, a moderating influence on some issues, has been a steadfast vote to limit the use of race in public programs, once writing, "It is a sordid business, this divvying us up by race." The court already has heard arguments in cases that could expand gun rights and religious rights, and also roll back abortion rights in a direct challenge to the Roe v. Wade ruling from 1973. Earlier this month, the justices weighed in for the first time on President Joe Biden's vaccine policies, halting a rule requiring a vaccine or testing at large businesses, while allowing a vaccine mandate for most of the nation's healthcare workers. The affirmative action case probably will be argued in the fall. Both suits were filed by Students for Fair Admissions, a Virginia-based group run by Edward Blum. He has worked for years to rid college admissions of racial considerations, and the court's new lineup breathed new life into his project. The group is calling on the court to overturn its 2003 ruling in Grutter v. Bollinger, which upheld the University of Michigan's law school admissions program. The Biden administration had urged the justices to stay away from the issue, writing in the Harvard case that the challenges cannot justify that extraordinary step of overruling the 2003 decision. Harvard President Lawrence Bacow said that the Ivy League institution does not discriminate and vowed to continue defending its admission plan. Considering race as one factor among many in admissions decisions produces a more diverse student body, which strengthens the learning environment for all, Bacow said in a statement. Blum voiced hope that the High Court will order an end to taking account of race in college admissions. Harvard and the University of North Carolina have racially gerrymandered their freshman classes in order to achieve prescribed racial quotas, Blum said in a statement. The Supreme Court has weighed in on college admissions several times over more than 40 years. The current dispute harks back to its first big affirmative action case in 1978, when Justice Lewis Powell set out the rationale for taking account of race, even as the court barred the use of racial quotas in admissions. In the Regents of the University of California versus Bakke, Powell approvingly cited Harvard as an illuminating example of a college that takes race into account in achieving the educational diversity valued by the First Amendment. 25 years later, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor likewise invoked the Harvard plan in her opinion in the Michigan Law School case. Now the Harvard program is under fire from opponents of race-based affirmative action. Students for Fair Admissions claims that Harvard imposes a racial penalty on Asian American applicants by systematically scoring them lower in some categories than other applicants and awarding massive preferences to Black and Hispanic applicants. Harvard flatly denies that it discriminates against Asian American applicants and said its consideration of race is limited, pointing out that lower courts agreed with the university. In 2020, the Federal Appeals Court in Boston ruled that Harvard looked at race in a limited way, in line with Supreme Court precedents. Harvard's freshman class is roughly 1/4 Asian American, 16% Black, and 13% Hispanic, Harvard says on its website. If Harvard were to abandon race-conscious admissions, African-American and Hispanic representation would decline by nearly half, the school told the court in urging it to stay out of the case. NAACP Legal and Educational Defense Fund Director Sherilyn Eiffel said that the court's decision to get involved in the issue was a threat to the country's ideals of equality. In addition to creating diverse student bodies that allow students to learn from each other's experiences, Eiffel said, affirmative action programs address systemic barriers Black students and students of color face in higher education. The court's decision today comes amidst the backdrop of widespread efforts to erase and deny the experiences of people of color, Eiffel said in a statement, as our country experiences a resurgence of white supremacy. It is as important now as ever before that our future leaders be educated in a learning environment that exposes them to the rich diversity that our country has to offer, so they may be fully prepared for the many challenges ahead. The Trump administration had backed Blum's case against Harvard and filed its own lawsuit alleging discrimination against Asian American and white people at Yale University. The Biden administration dropped the Yale suit. North Carolina's flagship public university prevailed in a federal district court in October. U.S. District Judge Loretta Biggs ruled that the school's program was intended to produce a diverse student body and had shown the benefits of doing so. FDA curbs use of antibody drugs sidelined by variant Omicron. Byline, Washington. COVID-19 antibody drugs from Regeneron and Eli Lilly should no longer be used because they are unlikely to work against the Omicron variant that now accounts for nearly all U.S. infections, U.S. House regulators said Monday. The Food and Drug Administration said it was revoking emergency authorization for both drugs that were purchased by the federal government and given to millions of Americans with COVID-19. If the drugs prove effective against future variants, the FDA said it could reauthorize their use. The regulatory move was expected because both drug makers had said the infusion drugs are less able to target Omicron due to its mutations. Still, the federal action could trigger pushback from some Republican governors who have continued promoting the drugs against the advice of health experts. Omicron's resistance to the two leading monoclonal antibody medicines has upended the treatment playbook for COVID-19 in recent weeks. Doctors have alternate therapies to combat early COVID-19 cases, including two new antiviral pills from Pfizer and Merck, but both are in short supply. An antibody drug from GlaxoSmithKline that remains effective also is in short supply. The drugs are laboratory-made versions of virus-blocking antibodies. They are intended to head off severe disease and death by supplying concentrated doses of one or two antibodies early in an infection. Then-President Donald Trump received Regeneron's antibody combination after he tested positive for the coronavirus in 2020. The U.S. government temporarily stopped distributing the two drugs in late December as Omicron was racing across the country to become the dominant variant. But officials resumed distribution after complaints from Republican governors, including Florida's Ron DeSantis, who claimed that the drugs continued to help some Omicron patients. DeSantis has heavily promoted antibody drugs as a signature part of his administration's COVID-19 response, setting up infusion sites and lauding them at news conferences, while opposing vaccine mandates and other public health measures. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has also launched state-sponsored infusion sites. The drugs are not a substitute for vaccination and are generally reserved for people who are the most vulnerable, including seniors, transplant recipients, and those with conditions like heart disease and diabetes. Regeneron and Lilly previously said they were developing new antibodies that target Omicron. The move comes days after regulators broadened the use of remdesivir, the first drug approved for COVID-19, to treat more patients. This was from the Associated Press. Possible elections security breach. Second county official investigated. Albert County clerk ordered to appear at deposition, by Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. Colorado Secretary of State Gina Griswold's office is investigating a second county clerk over a possible election security breach and has ordered Elbert County Clerk and Recorder Dallas Schroeder to turn over information related to allegations that he copied a voting system hard drive. The Democratic Secretary of State ordered the Republican county clerk to appear at a deposition February 7th to explain how the copy of the 2021 Dominion voting system's hard drive was made after Griswold's office said Schroeder did not respond to an email request and an election order requiring the disclosure of information about the potential security protocol breach. She also asked that video surveillance of voting equipment be turned on and that no one access the voting equipment unaccompanied. As Secretary of State, my top priority is to ensure that every eligible Coloradan, Republican, Democrat, and Independent alike, has access to secure elections, and I will always protect Colorado's election infrastructure, Griswold said in a statement. The Secretary of State's office said it doesn't believe the unauthorized imaging has created an imminent or direct security threat to Colorado's elections because of when it took place. This is not the first time the Secretary of State's office has launched an investigation over copies of election equipment hard drives. Last year, Griswold's office sued Republican Mesa County Clerk and Recorder Tina Peters over allegations of a security breach, resulting in a judge barring Peters from overseeing the 2021 election. And the Secretary of State's office is also trying to stop Peters from overseeing the 2022 election. Peters is still facing multiple lawsuits, ethics investigations, and a grand jury investigation of a possible elections breach in her office. Schroeder is part of a lawsuit against Griswold's office calling for an independent forensic audit of the 2020 election. A common refrain for those pushing baseless claims of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election. As part of the filings, the Secretary of State's office said Schroeder signed an affidavit dated January 7th, which states that he made a forensic image of everything on the election server, and I saved the image to a secure external hard drive that is kept under lock and key in the Elbert County Elections Office before the trusted build process took place. The trusted build is a routine update against vulnerabilities, according to the Secretary of State's office. Colorado House GOP Representative Ron Hanks of Fremont County filed the lawsuit initially, but a judge granted his request to withdraw earlier this month, with Hanks citing his work at the legislature and 2022 campaign for U.S. Senate. Other plaintiffs include Douglas County Clerk and Recorder Merlin Klotz, Rio Blanco County Commissioners Gary Moyer and Jeff Rector, and Park County Commissioner Amy Mitchell. Griswold's office has refuted the claims in the legal complaint, saying they're based on unfounded election conspiracy theories, and her office filed to dismiss the lawsuit. The plaintiffs have filed a motion asking to amend their complaint. In the affidavit, Schroeder states that he learned that the trusted build deleted election records in Mesa County, something Peters has claimed in her own legal battle with the Secretary of State's office. Schroeder did not respond to a request for comment from the Denver Post on Monday. Morphew case. CBI agent resigns amid probe by Shelley Bradbury, the Denver Post. A Colorado Bureau of Investigation agent who testified in the murder case against Chaffee County's Barry Morphew resigned from the agency last month amid an internal affairs investigation, according to a letter obtained by the Denver Post. Former agent Joseph Cahill resigned December 8th, 2 days before an internal affairs report was issued about an accidental discharge of his personal gun in his home while he was off duty, according to the so-called Brady letter, named after a U.S. Supreme Court decision that requires officer credibility issues to be disclosed during the court process. Pursuant to our responsibilities under Brady v. Maryland, I am writing to inform you that there may be information contained in a Colorado Bureau of Investigation internal affairs report, .. that may impact the credibility of Joseph Cahill, CBI Director John Camper wrote in the December 17th letter to 11th Judicial District Attorney Linda Stanley, who is prosecuting the case against Morphew. The CBI released the letter Monday following a public records request from the Post. Morphew, 54, is charged with first-degree murder in the death of his wife, Suzanne Morphew, who was 48 when she disappeared from the family's Chaffee County home in May 2020. Investigators believe Barry Morphew killed his wife in a fit of rage after discovering she had carried on a months-long extramarital affair, then lied and hid evidence to try to cover his tracks. Barry Morphew maintains that he is innocent, and his defense attorneys have argued that his wife may have run away or been kidnapped. During an August preliminary hearing, Cahill testified that investigators found male DNA on Suzanne Morphew's glove box that did not match her husband, but did correspond with partial DNA profiles found in three unsolved sexual assault cases in different states. At the time, 11th Judicial District Chief Judge Patrick Murphy called the DNA pretty critical evidence. He had since removed himself from the case over a potential conflict of interest. The case was reassigned to District Judge Ramsey Lama. It is not immediately clear how the Brady letter about Cahill's credibility would impact the case against Morphew, but the letter was discussed in court Monday during a pre-scheduled motions hearing. The hearing is expected to continue Tuesday. The CBI's letter did not include additional detail about the internal affairs investigation into Cahill and did not say why he resigned. Susan Medina, a spokeswoman for the CBI, declined to comment Monday. Cahill could not be reached. In the letter, Camper said CBI officials regret the situation. While I am disappointed that I need to pen this letter, it is important that you be made aware of this matter, Camper wrote. Morphew's attorneys could not be immediately reached. Marshall Fire, Scramble for Housing Adding Pressure to Tight Rental Market, by Noelle Phillips, The Denver Post. The ranch house in Louisville that Emily Teeter and her family of five rented before the Marshall Fire wasn't their dream home, but it was solid, had a big yard, and most importantly, it wasn't destroyed by fire, smoke, or wind. It was one of the few houses on their street to survive, although it needed to be cleaned top to bottom because of ash and soot. They considered moving because the family felt sad every time they drove past their neighbors' burned homes. Still, they decided to stay. We couldn't find another rental, Teeter said. They were going too fast, and they're expensive. But we have a solid house, and we can get it clean. Let's just stay in the area and deal with the sadness. Then last week, the family's landlord, with little explanation, sent notice to terminate their lease when it expires in March. The landlord gave them the option to pay month to month, with a 10% increase through May. We were shocked, Teeter said. We absolutely were shocked. Now the Teeter family will join the hundreds of other families searching for housing in an area that already had a tight market before the Marshall Fire destroyed 1,084 homes and damaged another 149 in Louisville, Superior, and parts of unincorporated Boulder County on December 30th. It's too early to know how much the Marshall Fire has impacted housing costs because it's been less than a month since the 6,000-acre wildfire's destruction. But those who are searching for housing say it is more expensive than ever. The most recent data shows vacancy rates rose slightly for all of Metro Denver to 4.3% in the last quarter of 2021 from 3.8% the previous quarter, according to the Apartment Association of Metro Denver. But that's typical for the last 3 months of the year, and that 3.8% was the tightest rental market the metro area has seen, said Drew Hamrick, the association's senior vice president of government affairs. Already, metro area rents average $1,873 per month, up 14.8% over the last year, according to data from Zillow. Add more than 1,000 new families looking for places to live, and those averages will rise, experts said. Many of those families were homeowners who now have returned, at least temporarily, to the rental market. If there's not enough vacancy, rents are going to go up because that's what the market is going to do, Hamrick said. Anecdotally, the market is commanding even higher prices for the housing that is available, said Amanda DeVito Parle, a realtor with REMAX and co-creator of a Marshall Fire Housing Needs and Availability Facebook page. She recently listed a four-bedroom, four-bathroom Arvada house for $850,000. She had 38 showings and five offers, and the sellers ultimately sold it for $55,000 above the asking price to Marshall Fire victims, she said. This week, she noticed a real estate listing for a burned lot in Superior's Sagamore neighborhood priced at $350,000, and that's before fire debris is cleared in a subdivision that was completely destroyed. Inventory is remarkably low, and prices are going up, DeVito Parley said. And anything near the fire is going to go up because of the shortage. After the fire, the apartment association identified more than 2,000 available rental units in the Denver area, Hamrick said. The rental market has rooms for the fire victims, but it will mean many families will need to move away from Superior and Louisville to find affordable places to live. We're presuming some people are just going to have to commute from this, he said. Things may get worse before they get better. On Thursday, Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser warned rental companies that his office will be watching for price gouging in connection with the fire. He sent letters to Airbnb, Zillow, Vrbo, and ReColorado after receiving an unspecified number of reports of landlords who excessively raised rent after the fire. He asked those website hosting companies to enforce fair practices among those who use their platforms to advertise vacancies. Distinguishing price gouging from fair market value may be tricky. Colorado law prohibits price gouging during a crisis, such as a wildfire or flood, but there's no formula for determining what that is. Instead, the Attorney General staff will have to determine the difference between landlords taking advantage of vulnerable people and what is expected when demand exceeds supply. His staff will watch current market averages and look for people who are charging much more than everyone else, he said. We have to be looking at the market conditions at the time so we can make a determination the seller is acting in an abusive way to take advantage of somebody, Weiser said. When someone decides I can take advantage of you right here and right now and charge you far outside market price, that is taking advantage of a vulnerable person. DeVito Parley expects average rental prices to at least triple in Boulder County based on what happened in Grand County after the East Troublesome Fire in 2020. This is what free markets look like when you have 1,000 houses gone and 1,000 families displaced, she said. COVID-19 in Colorado. Hospitalizations drop as Omicron wave recedes. However, deaths rise for first time since November, by Meg Wingerter, the Denver Post. Colorado's COVID-19 situation is getting better, and the state can hope for at least a few months of relative peace to prepare for whatever the virus does next, a member of the team modeling the virus's trajectory said Monday. Dr. John Samet, Dean of the Colorado School of Public Health, said the overall picture is improving at the moment, following the apparent peak of the Omicron variant surge in the state. The percentage of tests coming back positive and the number of new cases are both falling in Colorado, though from high levels, he said. COVID-19 deaths, however, stopped falling in the state and have risen again in the wake of the fast-spreading Omicron variant spike in infection and hospitalization. After the virus's fifth wave, driven by the Delta variant, peaked in the fall, deaths dropped from a weekly high of 262 in the third week of November to a low of 147 in the last week of December. So far, the state has recorded 151 deaths in the first week of January, though that number could further increase as delayed reports come in. More than 11,000 people have died due to COVID-19 in Colorado since the pandemic started. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment reported 65,287 new COVID-19 cases in the week ending Sunday. That number will likely rise as late reports come in. but it's unlikely to reach the 86,747 cases reported the previous week. An average of 24.5% of tests came back positive, though, suggesting the state still doesn't have a good picture of how widespread the virus is. That number, while down from a recent high of nearly 30%, is still far off the goal of 5%. Hospitalizations of people across Colorado with confirmed COVID-19 dropped over the weekend from 1,629 on Friday to 1,581 on Monday. Hospital capacity remains tight, though, with an average of 92% of intensive care beds and 93% of general beds in use over the last week. The Colorado chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians issued a news release Sunday saying its members no longer thought it was necessary for the state to activate crisis standards of care unless the number of COVID-19 patients starts to rise again. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.